days are gone and the back says nigh. I beg in the places where I used to be, and I'm crazy for cash, but I ain't got none. Oh, I'm just paying my rent every day. Oh, and there's a hour of debt.
Welcome back to Background Briefing. Joining us now is Andrew Ross, who is Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. He's written for The New York Times, Art Forum, The Nation, Newsweek, and The Village Voice, and is also author and editor of many, many books, including, fairly recently, The University Against Itself, The NYU Strike and the Future of the Academic Workplace, and Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Time. Welcome to the program, Andrew Ross.
Thank you, Toby.
So, are times particularly precarious right now?
To say the least, yes. Although I think it does take a bunch of very, very crazy politicians to expose some truths at the very core of the global financial economy, which is what's been happening on Capitol Hill in the last week or so. The very rapid erosion of trust in what is a pillar of the global economy, the almighty dollar, and the U.S. Treasury in particular, I think has come as a big surprise to people. And it's just one more milestone, perhaps, in the continuing decline or erosion of American dominance in the world at large. The many ways of interpreting the milestone, I'm sure, but precarious is certainly a good code word for what's been going on.
A few years ago, some of us thought the euro might be a threat to the dollar as the reserve currency, but now the Chinese are actually publicly advocating that they step in and become the reserve currency.
Well, I think perhaps prematurely, but who knows, in 50 years' time, that claim may look a lot different. But certainly for the time being, there's far too much invested, both economically and also psychologically. Too much invested in the dollar for that to happen. I think if there was a transition to some other currency, it would have to be a much more sober one. That it wouldn't be a transition that would happen as a result of some emergency of the sort that we might have been facing, we might still face, depending on how the House votes. But maybe 50 years' time, the Chinese claim will look different.
Now, in terms of the debt issue, which is what we're alluding to in part, my understanding is that you have a book coming out fairly soon on that topic. Could you tell us what the book is?
Well, the book is called Creditocracy and the Case for Debt Refusal. And it's, as the title suggests, there's really two components to it. One is to describe the society that we now live in, which I call a creditocracy, and that's one in which government or the holding of power in the interest of a creditor class is the dominant form of government. Or to put it another way, it's a society where even the most basic or vital needs are required to be debt financed. So increasingly we find that the bare requirements of life for many Americans are things that they have to take on debt in order to have access to. That's the kind of society I describe as a creditocracy. The other part of it, the other component, is the case for debt refusal, which the book argues really is that under these circumstances, it's not only an act of civil disobedience, legitimate civil disobedience, to refuse or repudiate household debts. It may be the only way of restoring popular democracy in a country like this. So there are many moral and legal arguments that the book explores that underpin the case it's making for debt repudiation, specifically of household debts.
Can you explain to us what you mean by debt repudiation? It sounds good if I can sign up for it.
Well, the case has already been made for the sovereign debts of many countries in the global south. that are perceived to have been delivered into a debt trap that they can't escape. Sovereign debt to many global south countries are a burden that weighs upon the prospects for development. And so at a certain point, for the last 20 years or so, groups have been lobbying the major creditor powers in the north for debt cancellation. And so that case has been made, and although a lot of the promises have yet to be fulfilled, there has been some degree of debt repudiation or debt cancellation for the global south. In Europe right now, in the Eurozone, there's a similar case being argued for the repudiation of the external debts that were incurred specifically by Mediterranean countries in the Eurozone, like Greece and Spain, Italy and Ireland and Portugal. What we haven't seen yet, although we're beginning to see, is a case being made for repudiation of household debts. And that's what the book takes on, really. It's try and build on these previous campaigns that argue that it's a legitimate and an honorable thing to refuse debts imposed by foreign bondholders and banks, and apply that to household debts like education debt or medical debt or even housing debt, credit card debt.
Now, you say that it's an honorable thing to do. Can you explain the case for that?
Well, in the case of odious debt, for example, which is sort of recognized internationally, where, let's say, an authoritarian government or a dictator takes out loans on behalf of his or her country, often diverts the funds into their own bank accounts so that, in fact, the money doesn't really have to travel very far because it's coming from banks in the north and it's getting deposited in the accounts of the dictators in the north. These kinds of debts are referred to as odious debts, and a successor government can make the case that they shouldn't be paid because they weren't the result of a sovereign or democratic process. There are other kinds of illegitimate debt, people have argued, debts that are used to generate environmental damage, debts that are made that when the creditor knows they can never possibly be repaid, debts that are made and negotiated by corrupt officials. When you break it down and you do a proper kind of debt auditing, you can figure out which debts should be paid, which debts are legitimate, and those that are illegitimate. And the mechanism for doing that is to do a citizen's debt audit, which is becoming a sort of popular thing to do in Europe these days. It can be done at every level, at almost every institution. For example, in this country, there are efforts to audit the municipal debts of cities like Detroit, which are being held to ransom by Wall Street banks that sold very dodgy or toxic loan products to municipal officers. But it can also be done of institutions like utilities or universities, nonprofit institutions that have been sold a bill of goods, let's say, by a Wall Street bank, which is very common. And so the members of these institutions are being asked to, to assume the costs, the burden of the debts, illegitimately.
I'm speaking with Andrew Ross, Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. He's published in the New York Times, Art Forum, The Nation, Newsweek, and The Village Voice. He's also author and editor of numerous books, including The University Against Itself, The NYU Strike and the Future of the Academic Workplace, and Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Time. He's talking about a forthcoming book, which I think I've got the right title of, Andrew, Creditocracy and the Case for Debt Refusal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, in terms of alternatives, you've outlined a few of those for us. What are the pressure points that activists and, in a sense, alternative economists, as it were, are able to apply? Where are the weak spots in terms of governments and the financial institutions that are clearly rorting the system?
Well, in so far as there does exist regulatory channels between government and the major financial institutions. It's pretty clear that something has broken down there and that the major banks are beyond regulation, so to speak. In fact, earlier this year, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder actually confessed to the Senate Judiciary Committee that the banks really have too much concentrated power. It's difficult for us to prosecute them, he said. If you do bring a criminal charge, it has a negative impact on the national economy and perhaps even the global economy. And I think that was a very important moment. It was, I mean, some people might think it refreshing, others might think it alarming, you know, to hear that the nation's top law enforcement official acknowledged that he was legally helpless in the face of these too big to fail banks, that there is no possibility that they can be regulated. We don't expect that much from elected officials at this point. They've had 5 years to pass tighter regulation, and they've also had 5 years to deliver debt relief to American households that are severely burdened. The record has been very thin. The banks have only gotten bigger and more powerful, and there's been virtually no effort at systematic debt relief. So looking to government at this point in time is not going to produce a lot of results, and it'll be a waste of energy for a lot of people.
So that suggests direct action as an alternative. Is that right?
Well, yes. I think, and some of the groups that I've been involved in, debt resistance groups, Strike Debt in particular, is a group that I work with, which is an Occupy offshoot. We basically believe that people have to take debt relief for themselves by any means necessary, and that can take a variety of channels. But it's very much in keeping with the Occupy ethos that, you know, our elected officials are very much in the pocket of the creditor class and are not in a position to pass reforms or legislation that counters the interests of the creditor class. And so direct action, civil disobedience, building alternative kinds of economies, these are the kinds of pathways that we need to follow if we're going to see any real change.
And you say that some of these activities in these groups emerge out of Occupy. Perhaps you could just tell us a bit more about that. First of all, tell us what happened to Occupy, and then secondly, tell us about the new formation.
Well, everyone has their own story about Occupy. I think you'll find that the ethos and many of the tactics of Occupy are still nourishing the work of various groups. It certainly does. That certainly is the case with Strike Debt, which is an alliance that came together last year of various Occupy groups dedicated to building a debtors' movement. Two of the things I think we're more well known for in Strike Debt, I could mention perhaps. One is something called the Debt Resistors Operations Manual, which you can download from our website, strikedebt.org. And that's a very useful volume that gives advice to debtors about how to renegotiate their debts or evict the power of debtors from their daily lives. The other project that became quite well known is something called the Rolling Jubilee. We raise money and we abolish debt that is purchased on the secondary debt marketplace. Distressed debt will be sold for pennies on the dollar to debt collectors, and then the debt collectors basically try to collect on the full amount of the debt. What we do is we go in and we buy the debt very cheaply and then abolish it, so the debtors are off the hook. It barely makes a dent, of course, in the volume of secondary debt. It's not supposed to be a solution to the debt crisis, but it's a kind of act of public education. And as a result of what we've been doing with the Rolling Jubilee, a lot more people are aware of how cheaply their debts have been bought. And so when the debt collector harasses you on the phone and you know how cheaply he or she has bought your debt for, you probably have a different attitude towards paying back what they're asking. So it changes the psychology of the debtor, just knowing how that secondary debt marketplace works.
And that kind of information is probably going to assist with a particular word that I think a lot of folks perhaps struggle with who are in debt, namely shame. There is such a dreadful stereotyping in the bourgeois media of people in debt in this country that is quite antithetical to, as you said, the complete reliance on a debt culture as part of the fabric of the social order. I wondered if I could ask you in the last couple of minutes to talk about a particular area that I know you're an expert in, along with these other domains of debt, and that's specifically student debt. Where are we with that? Last time I looked, I think it was at somewhere around $1 trillion, wasn't it?
It will be approaching $1.2 trillion probably by the end of the year, yes. And that's, you know, that's awful. If you watch what Capitol Hill does, I mean, one of the more the cruel and inhumane spectator sports of the summer was watching congressional representatives debate whether to raise or lower interest rates by a point or two. It's an appalling thing to have to watch, but that's the state of government action on this issue. And this is a year in which government profit from federal student loans is estimated at $51 billion. That's difficult for people to understand how the government can profit from a federal loan program and plow the profits not into education, but into paying down the federal debt. In other words, paying off wars. The cost of wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I know time is short, so I'll just say one thing about this, Toby. I think everyone knows how expensive college is, but hardly anyone knows how cheap a free system would be. And one of our estimates of straight debt is that if you eliminated the long list of tax credits and exemptions that currently subsidize the student loan system, you would save more than $37 billion. Students spend about $60 billion on tuition at public colleges and universities. So if you subtracted all of the existing credits and exemptions at $37 billion, and if you reclaimed the money that's inappropriately allocated to for-profit colleges, you get savings of, you know, more than $47 billion, which leaves just $12.5 billion to be accounted for. I mean, that's all it would take, a little over $12 billion a year in additional funding to make public education in this country entirely free. That's a very paltry sum when you put it into the federal budget, when you put it alongside the tens of billions of dollars that are unaccounted for in the defense spending system or any other, you know, large item that might strike your listeners as inappropriate.
Sure.
And so it really wouldn't cost very much to cover the tuition of every student at 2- and 4-year public colleges in this country and allow the U.S. to join the long list of countries that do offer free higher education. It's something that's very little known.
What would that mean, just quickly, for private educational institutions and for-profit ones?
Well, it's a good question. It would mean that they would be the gap in price between, you know, top public colleges and many private colleges is getting smaller and smaller. And one of the things that one of the reasons why private colleges have been able to maintain their high tuition levels is because they're not all that much more expensive these days than good public universities. So making public education entirely free would certainly have an impact on how private universities did their business. But the private sector really is something that is highly subsidized, of course, by federal loans. I mean, the largest source of revenue in private universities is through the federal loan system. So it certainly would have an impact. On the for-profit system, well, I'm one of those educators that believes that the for-profit system shouldn't exist at all. I think it fails to perform on almost every metric, and it's inimical to my idea of education, that people would profit from offering these services in the first place. So I'd be quite happy to see the for-profit sector disappear.
And so say all of us. Andrew Ross, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Nice to talk to you, Toby.
I've been speaking with Andrew Ross, Professor of Social and Cultural Analysis at New York University. He's published in the New York Times, Art Forum, The Nation, Newsweek, and The Village Voice. And he's author and editor of numerous books, which include The University Against Itself, The NYU Strike and the Future of the Academic Workplace, and Nice Work If You Can Get It, Life and Labor in Precarious Time. His forthcoming volume is entitled Creditocracy and the Case for Debt Refusal. We'll take a break for station identification, and then joining us after that will be Sara Aish from Greenpeace to talk about the Arctic 30.